I once saw this picture on the internet of Nathan Irizarry's very blonde, adorable, French-speaking son, George Irizarry, locked inside a dog crate. I'm just gonna put that out there right now up front before I say anything else. He's blurring the lines, folks. Here's what I mean. Fiction has an amazing quality to take what is real and turn that reality into something off-kilter. Strange, but oddly true. But too many times have I read fiction that is exactly real life, yet exactly untrue. I'm talking about the line of believability. You can tell me in fiction that Hank lost his girlfriend and now he's unbearably sad, but I don't buy it. Or I'm bored. More likely is that I'm bored. That situation is real, sure, but it doesn't get at the core of reality. So when a writer like Nathan tells me a ghost is speaking to a dead friend through energy fields manifested in blackouts and flickering light bulbs, I am so, so eager to believe. I am watching the lamps on my kitchen table eating dinner. I am scared of the light bulbs in my bedroom at night, watching them all the while thinking, "Grandpa, is that you?" Here's what I like about Nathan, and there's a lot, but I'm restricted for the most part to talk about his fiction. He has more guts than you do. When I say you, I'm including myself, and I have a lot of very good things to say about myself, but I mean it when I say that Nathan has more guts than I do, more than you, more fire under his writer's ass, more heat to look at and wonder about, more madness to look upon and despair. He's trying things we wouldn't. Here's a passage from the end of one of his recent stories. "These talking apes have such remarkable powers while alive, can bring light to the darkness or snuff it out at will, and make such a beautiful arc, Roman candles across the sky, but in the end they will just crash and burn and die." There's an excerpt from a workshop letter I sent to Nathan about one of his stories. It goes, "God damn it, I really like this story. This is just an example. See, I've never liked San Francisco because I think it's too pretty. One time as a child, I saw this amazing golden statue of a man on Pier 39, and then the statue started to move, and I've never liked the city since. But until I read Nathan's fiction, I never really feared the place. And like San Francisco, like that spray-painted man I thought was a statue who wasn't, Nathan's stories delightfully deceive us. A trick on time, image, reality. But while deceiving us, he directs us to a terrible truth. And this is his fiction, fear of a life that exists, that is real, that you wish wasn't. In my world, there is a God who looks curiously similar to Nathan Irizarry, who stands above our world watching chaos unfold. As thousands march on Wall Street, as hundreds of thousands burn down Athens, as tigers and lions are on the loose in southern Ohio, I imagine a Nathan Godhead above us all, laughing at the inevitable downfall of man, waiting as we consume ourselves as a snake might latch onto its tail and swallow. All the while, Nathan laughing, mwah-ha-ha-ha-ha. Yet somehow, I am very, very comforted that we have Nathan behind this mess. I'd like to point out one thing that probably only Nathan and I will share in common in this room, and that is, "Ein Stößchen Neubauten." And I want to give you a very creepy lyric from that band, which I find very fitting to begin with tonight. "You will find me, if you want me, in the garden, unless it is pouring down with rain." Let us begin. I give you Nathan.
My God. Thank you, Carl. Seagor. I love Carl's work. Reads as says great writers write. Love it. So thank you. It may have been too much of a build-up, but we'll see how we do. I first want to thank the creative writing faculty at the University of Montana for giving me the opportunity to recreate myself in a new medium. And so in honor of that, tonight I'll be reading straight fiction. No nudity, no grease paint, no chemical fog, no strange smells, nope. I also want to express my appreciation for my cohorts, past and current, and everybody there in the program, the poets, I love the poets. Also, my appreciation for the English department as a whole. In a town of stray dogs, I consider myself fortunate to have landed there. I want to embarrass somebody who appears to have disappeared. My partner, my best reader, the street. That woman at the bar looks like she's about to give birth any hour. And I want to thank you all for coming here. Let's have fun. I'm going to read Sugar. They all laughed. Of course, it was a total setup. Take the one kid who didn't know anybody, because he just got to this town, and then got pulled out of school and stuck at home for almost a year, missed most of summer, and then come back finally, only to get put into fourth, a grade up, so he was smaller than everyone, and then to put him up in front as a volunteer to read that poem. There once was a lady from Niger, who smiled as she, except he didn't read Niger, didn't know the country or the word, and gave it a soft I and an extra G. Didn't even know that word, had maybe heard it somewhere, maybe not, but that's what came out, and she who had set him up, Mrs. Whatever, stopped him with great fanfare, and from the front of the room, as Roman still stood there beside his desk while everyone else sat, proceeded to lecture him on pronunciation, unmentioned the rest, awkwardly, the pall that hung in the air of that awful, what Roman now understood as perhaps a little more than bad language by the way they all laughed at him, some nervously, and looks of disbelief, contempt, all of them except him. Calvin Mayfield, for his measure, simply looked around at them, stared, narrowed eyes, and surveyed them the way Roman had seen livestock surveyed from above, landscape, and the thought occurred to him that he has me, them to him, like them to me. It wasn't the first time that the boy, near a head above everybody else, an obvious year older, had stood out, been noticed, but not just because he was taller. The way he looked at people seemed to make them uncomfortable. And his jeans had holes like Roman's, or patches, and in the cafeteria he used the red card for lunch card for poor kids. He wore white t-shirts and slicked his hair back like a man, a habit of putting it back into place, and Robin wouldn't have been surprised if he actually did have a pack of cigarettes rolled up in his sleeve. And the name, Calvin Mayfield. He sounded like a fake name, a pulp action hero, like Doc Savage, Sterling Stryker, or Cat Ballou. No, it wasn't the first time that Roman had noticed him. Hyperactive. Who wasn't hyperactive? What kid wasn't hyper? Yeah, there were the ones that acted like they'd been hit on the head, like little zombies. There were a few, and people actually did sometimes wonder if they'd been hit on the head, but mostly, everyone was crazy. Roman, though, happened to be the lucky one who got to go see a doctor. Every week, down in a strange section of town, by the hospital, in a long, low building built for the desert, to spend an hour alone in the dark office of Dr. Gonzalez. 6 months of talking and drawing and looking at drawings and talking until the man finally fixed him with something that he later learned to pronounce, because it hadn't fixed him, had actually made him worse, actually almost killed him, and this is how. Thrombocytopenia purpura, which he got from being given phenothiazines. He carefully memorized it, could repeat it perfectly, and would have impressed kids if he had actually known any, but instead impressed adults like Mr. Duncan, who came from the school to the house 2 days a week to teach him, because, and this would have impressed the kids even more, thrombocytopenia purpura meant that he wouldn't stop bleeding. A shortage of platelets. To his brothers, the partner in crime, when here's Junior, and the littler one, the tag-along, be careful with him. If he starts bleeding internally, he can die. And so, to their dismay, he was untouchable. But to that upside, the downside that he couldn't go outside, couldn't play, couldn't be caught leaving the, what they would simply call the house, but soon would learn to think of the first of two, the future other one being their father's. And then he recovered, as unpredictably as he had succumbed, because there was no cure. There's no cure for thrombocytopenia purpura. Just got better after 9 months of weekly visits to the nurse, each time a finger prick, careful, quick, with a delicately unwrapped hygienic metal point, then disposed, blood smear across a glass slide with a microscope, and then in one great finale, a bone marrow tap from the femur while he lay on his stomach on a metal gurney in a dim-lit room, half-naked, in an open-back hospital gown. One last test to confirm, completely recovered, platelets! Just in time for the hot August end of summer. A few last weeks of freedom to get outside and enjoy with his brothers that long, hot march for sugar. Along a long, straight road through the Badlands, under the white sun to the 7-Eleven, walking together first to the edge of the neighborhood, past the supermarket, and then out into the great undeveloped open. No more side streets, nothing but dirt. This was land that once turned over and forsaken was quickly reclaimed by the desert. Nothing would grow until the shabby grasses had long worked the dirt. Nothing grown there for money would have survived without the canals. This was where, in December, they had built a snowman out of tumbleweeds. And today, in late August, the blazing sun watched them collect bottles and cans from the roadside into a bag as they walked. Enough for one large Slurpee for the three of them. It was a zero-sum game on thirst. All that walking, they would end up back home just as thirsty, just as penniless. But it was a big win on sugar. It was all worth it just to taste the sweetness. One day, when they returned from the Slurpee walkabout, the parents sat them down and explained the divorce. Serious matters in their expressions when they asked Roman and his brothers upstairs and into the master bedroom, patted the large bed, and they climbed up on. "We want you to know this has nothing to do with you," they told them. Then the moving out, though we both love you very much. They all three looked back at them blankly, not understanding the problem. A second house sounded like a pretty good deal. There was a brief, silent standoff as the boys waited for a cue. "Well, aren't you going to cry?" they asked, and so first Roman and then the others followed suit and began to cry. Tears dried quickly on their way back downstairs, and wholly unconcerned with the imminent separation, they soon sat together watching television for what would normally be at least 3 or 4 hours, occasionally fighting over the pliers that they used to change the channel. They almost always agreed on what show to watch, but everyone wanted to just hold the tool, to feel in his lap, clutched firmly with both hands, the power of the pliers. A week later, Roman started going off to school, close enough to walk, alone, 5 blocks of rights and lefts, to sit among the unfamiliar faces, to get set up and embarrassed in front of them, to to loll about and read during recess and eat lunch at the far end of a long table in the cafeteria. It was Sloppy Joe Day, and so things could have been worse. The first French fry hit the table in front of his tray and slid past. He knew enough to ignore. The second hit his shoulder and fell to the floor. That brought more laughter, a hit. Risky to look over, and Roman tried staring straight ahead or down at his food, took another bite and chewed, but his eyes were getting red, and with another hit onto his tray, he found it irresistible and looked over at the four or five boys down the table. Most of them were laughing. Roman wrapped the last of his burger in a napkin, four neat folds, and slipped it into a coat pocket. As he stood up, he stumbled against the bench, stepped over and extracted a leg. He walked off in the opposite direction and out. Standing at the urinal, Roman stared straight ahead when he heard them come in. Saw three from the side of his head, and soon they were directly behind him, crowded together. They pushed in, and he felt one boy's chest against his back, into his ear, close, and he felt his warm breath, a French fry. Roman felt his butthole tighten in a spasm. He could hear voices echoing in from the outside, far away. And then, as if conjured out of the air, Calvin Mayfield came in a slow, hot wind, walked in, strode in like a hero, and surveyed, expressionless, scanned the room, and the boys immediately backed away. He stopped and stared at them, and they broke apart, looked down and away, moved tentatively past and out. That look of his. Roman tucked himself into his fly as he turned and met his eyes. Gray eyes. Who has gray eyes? Calvin Mayfield looked down at Roman's crotch, his fly, his open fly. Roman zipped his pants and looked up. He smiled, but the boy showed nothing, and so Roman made his way out. Their father's new house was a 5-minute walk away, an easy route that went over the freeway, through empty lots, and then right through or right past the old graveyard, depending on the time of day, since in the warm settling dusk, they could hear voices coming from within the walls. Roman would end up often walking back and forth between the house and the other house, sometimes with his brothers, sometimes alone. He would come to like getting there as much as being there. That first day, as he walked the interior of his new second home, empty and echoing, still uncurtained and unlit, he looked out a front living room window at the overgrown yard, to the houses across the street, to the one house with bare dirt in front. And he startled to see there, looking right at him, Calvin Mayfield, standing in the sunlight, shirtless, arms hanging at his sides, a hammer in his right hand. Roman ducked out of the window, looked around the room, still empty, realized he had caught his breath, was now breathing. He had already waited too long. He half expected him to be standing directly there in front of the window, but he forced himself to lean over to see sliver by sliver more of the street outside, now an empty scene in its bright entirety. Summer was slipping away fast. Clouds and winds would threaten here and there for a while, from here on out. But the air was perfectly dry, the sky clear that day. At recess, the hot sun bore down, and Mr. James likely wished a wind would come up to break the stillness. It had started with shouting heard across the grass, and everyone had moved from their milling and such toward the commotion. Crowds always make an arena. And in the center of this one stood Mr. James, that lieutenant colonel general of a vice principal who kept a ping pong paddle in his office to spank kids, wore sunglasses, side-parted blow-dried hair that looked like a helmet, and today appeared in three shades of muted green in a polyester suit and tie. He was an enforcer. Facing him down was Calvin Mayfield. "You come over here right now. Go to hell," Calvin's voice broke as he leaned into his shout. Mr. Mayfield, you come over here right now. He pointed a stiff finger at the ground in front of him. Calvin was backing away, and the crowd widened for him. Go to hell. Calvin, I order you to come here right now. The bell rang, and then stopped, but nobody moved. A car drove by on the edge of the playground. I'm leaving. His face was red. I forbid you to leave this school. It is illegal to leave this school without permission, and I forbid it. Calvin Mayfield drew back. His entire body arched. He sniffed hard as he threw back his head, and he heard the wet gurgle of phlegm cleared up out of his throat. Watched him tip back like a dancer, an athlete, and then lunge forward, his shoulders thrown too as he spit-hurled the gob through the air and his hair fell across his face. It hit Mr. James square on his thigh and clung to the olive polyester weave. Mr. James stared at him. Stoic, square-jawed, his kabuki being to appear unshaken, he looked down at the snot. Unflinching, he reached down and ran his forefinger tight against the fabric to collect it, but when he pulled his hand away, he simply stretched a long strand that sparkled in the light. He whipped his fingers in the air to release the offense and wiped the remainder on his pant leg. The crowd was already parting as Calvin Mayfield walked long strides away across the playground, right past the edge of school and onto the street. Roman could see him crying, but he still thought, not a frail bone in his body. Roman was at the new house alone, had been in the backyard timidly peeking into the abandoned shed, near empty and visibly infested with hundreds of black widow spiders in a complex of webs. A swatch of sunlight entered through the door and lit a rectangle on the dirt floor. Spiders had scampered out of the light and stopped in the shadows. His father came out of the house, had been painting, and gave him change for a soda, no strings attached, a short walk to the liquor store. Still good days for cold soda in the sun, and so he walked around the side of the house and out toward the street. Of course, there he was, stepping out of his door across the street and shouting back into it, "Go to hell!" Roman froze. He stepped slowly back, not to appear to be retreating, slowly, not to stare, not to look away. Roman went out by the alleyway instead, a side street, two blocks up, block over, past a dry, flat field along the freeway, then back. He decided he had might as well sit down there in the alleyway. It was a good spot. A week earlier, he had found some magazines in a stack next to one of the trash cans. There were some comic books, and there was one magazine not meant for kids. It had pictures of women with their shirts off, but it also had a picture of four heads on a table, human heads that had been chopped off in a war and set out in a row for the photo. One of them had its eyes open. He wished he hadn't looked at that picture. The sun was shining in a nice way, not too hot, soothing, seemed even to caress the trash cans and make their metal glow. He slid down with his back against a fence, one house down from his father's, far enough away from the shed, and set the can down on the ground next to him. He rotated it back and forth to flatten the dirt beneath it, and the dust climbed up an inch from the bottom and mixed into the condensation. But above that, the colored aluminum was bright and clean and wet. It called out to be opened, but he waited. He heard the footsteps in the gravel before he looked up to see him. The boy was looking directly at him, walking directly too, and when he got to him, he stood there for a moment. He had a bit of blood in one nostril, and his lower lip was swollen. His eyes were red because he had been crying. He turned and sat down beside him, not across from, but right beside him, and they sat there for a bit, side by side, and said nothing. Then Roman reached down and popped the top of the soda. He handed it to him, first sip. He took a drink and handed it back.